Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hardy. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Good afternoon and welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to Kildare's KFM. It's Caoimhe Hardy here with you until 3. It's Thursday, the 19th of October. Coming up first on today's show, we'll speak to Yvonne Woods, Campaigns and Communications Manager at the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. There's an increase of calls to the National Helpline with over 18,000 calls made last year. At 2.20, Miriam Dignan will talk to us. She's a leading member of the Women's Ordination Worldwide Group, and we'll be talking about the ordination of women into the church. At 2.35, Dr. Mary Doherty, founder of Autistic Doctors International and Associate Clinical Professor at the UCD School of Medicine, will talk to us about the problems that autistic people face, premature death risk due to health barriers, so says a study by this Irish medic. And then lastly, we'll be hearing about Irish folk remedies. So if you've any Irish folk remedies, do text in 0833 97 97 97. You can email me to studio@kfmradio.com or you can call in 045 898 999. Now, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre supported 18,400 people last year, up on 31% on 2021. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Yvonne Woods, Campaigns and Communications Manager at the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Good afternoon, Yvonne.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe. Thanks for having us on.
Delighted to have you, Yvonne. Talk us through the findings of this report. Fairly stark.
Okay, they are indeed. I suppose what the report really overall shows is that there is a really vast need out there for support around for survivors of sexual violence and people who are affected by sexual violence right across the country. As you mentioned there, we had 18,400 contacts with the National Helpline in 2022, and that was up quite starkly from the year before. You know, our helpline staff will tell you that a lot of people were presenting, you know, in quite severe mental health difficulties, that they were coming forward because they would have heard a lot of, I suppose, reports in the media around sexual violence. And what we're, I suppose, in a way, we're glad that we're seeing that number, because we're seeing that people are reaching out and they're seeking support and they're receiving it on the National Helpline, which is 24 hours, and where it's a free line, it's confidential, and people are able to call, you know, when they need to. So while most of those contacts were for the first time, just over 9,000 would have been for first time, a lot of people would also be calling back, you know, multiple times to get support on the line, which is, you know, which is there whenever they need it, and we're very glad to see it. And I suppose another feature of the line in that year was that we saw a good rise in our web chat support. And that is a relatively new service that we started up, I suppose, during COVID, where people maybe who don't have the space or the time to make a phone call can actually message in on our website. And that rose actually 46% up from the year before to 607 people that we were supporting last year, and we increased our hours as well to kind of meet that demand. So yes, on the National Helpline, which we run, we would have seen quite a large increase there in the calls, but we also would have seen a big increase in our work on accompaniment, and that's with people who are either going in to attend the sexual assault treatment unit, which in Dublin is in the Rotunda Hospital. There are six all over the country. And then also with people who are thinking about reporting sexual violence. So we provide that service where we might explore that with them and talk about their concerns and fear around that. And if they then decide to go forward and report to Gardaí or to another forum, which can often happen, there can be other places where you can report sexual violence, that we'd be able to go with them and accompany with them and provide that kind of emotional support. Also around in the courts as well, obviously the criminal courts would be where we would do most of that work, but other fora as well, to be able to go with them and to provide support to them and information as they need it, just around that idea of going into the courts. And that rose quite starkly last year as well. I suppose we would have seen in the sexual assault treatment unit, we would have seen a very large increase there. We supported 291 victims and survivors who were seeking that forensic and health treatment treatment. That was up 153%. And then in the justice system, again, we would have supported 331 victims and survivors and some friends and family in those justice settings. Mm. So, yeah, a lot of work done in those particular fora.
Okay. Mainly women calling in, mainly females calling in. 84% were helped by the National Helpline. 15.7% of callers were males. In comparison to the year before, is there more men calling in, or is it still kind of relatively the same?
It's relatively more or less the same. It's more or less the same. And we are obviously keen to ensure that people of all genders can call the helpline. The helpline is there for everybody. And, you know, we do try to, like, encourage people to come forward wherever they need it and as they need it. So, yes, it is more or less stable at that. And among our therapy clients as well, it would have been also mostly female. It was up over 90% of the clients were female during 2022. But, you know, it is the case that we do try to encourage people to come forward no matter what their gender.
Okay. Just sticking on the therapy clients then, I see that it was down one person. So 551 therapy clients were helped in 2022, down one from 580 in 2021. A slight drop, obviously, there. This, they say, is due to the restrictions in recruitment of therapists. Quite difficult, is it, at the DOCC to get therapists?
We have, I suppose, we're the rise in demand for supports around therapy has proven like that. Like a lot of agencies are all looking for, I suppose, therapists at the moment. So we did have challenges there. We're a charity. We're restricted in terms of like the salary we can offer. Yeah. Our therapists are highly, highly skilled. They're very specialised in the area of sexual violence. And, you know, our head of therapy would have been talking about that a bit later at the launch today. But, you know, that we are seeing cases presenting where there's, you know, a lot of violence in the attacks at the needs of the therapists or of the clients are such that those therapists need to be extremely carefully trained, and we need to explore new treatments and procedures and ways to go with them all the time, meeting people where they are and as they need it. So I suppose, yes, it was a challenge for us, and we had people who were retiring and moving on in different ways. So the number of therapists was down in 2022, but we have been successfully hiring in this year. So we're back on track again, I suppose, to look after clients as best we can. But with that, then we would have offered more, as we call them, care calls from the helpline, which was just to make sure that people were getting some support as they waited to get on to therapy.
Just back to therapy then as well, or staying on it, someone has texted in, is the therapy free at the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre? Is there any charge?
There can be a charge, all right. We do not turn anybody away who cannot afford to pay. And there's information on that on the website. But there would be a sliding scale, I suppose, depending on what people are able to afford.
Okay. Just lastly then, child abuse survivors, 95% of people in therapy were child abuse survivors. A very high number there.
Among our therapy clients, actually, it would have been it's a kind of a mix between adults and children. So it's between over 60% who would have been disclosing sexual violence experience as adults, and then about 37-38% as children.
Okay.
So it is a mix. That is kind of the mix that we would see quite regularly. And we've been working hard as well to develop ways for people to seek support outside even of the therapy. So during 2022, we were working on a new resource, Finding Your Way After Sexual Violence. And that's on our website right now. And it's quite good in the sense that it explores all of the terms, the definitions, what the various things mean. And it provides information for people who are thinking about therapy, or for people who are thinking about reporting, or for people who are thinking about going to court, and explains all about SATU and so on, Sexual Assault Treatment Unit. So it's very much, we're trying to work so that people can access the information as much as possible. I'd like as well, just to give the helpline number, because I know that whenever these issues come up in the media, and it's really important that these issues come up in the media, because people do need to be aware of the vast extent of sexual violence in our society. But to mention that if people are affected in any way, that they can always ring that helpline. And the number is 1800 77 88 88, and it's open all hours, and it's free and it's confidential, and you'll get support and reference to more information there.
Okay, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Absolutely.
Before you go, Yvonne, I suppose you can look at it at two sides of the coin, up 31% on last year. But that also means that more people are reaching out, more people are looking for support, not necessarily that there's more victims of, you know, rape or whatnot, because people are feeling that they can come to you for support, and other centres, I'm sure.
That is exactly right. And so while we see it as a sign that it is a vast problem in our society, and I think the Central Statistics Office statistics that came out over the course of the last few months show us that it absolutely is a giant problem, I think what it also shows, as you say, is that more people feel they can reach out to us and that they're looking for help from whatever centres are out there. There is Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, of course, covering Dublin and the surrounding areas, but there are 15 other rape crisis centres in Ireland, and they all have helplines and therapy services that are available. So, of course, we would encourage people to ring, if they ring the national helpline number that I just gave there, 1800 77 88 88, they will also give you all the details on those other rape crisis centres and all the supports that they provide.
Okay, Yvonne Woods, Campaigns and Communications Manager at the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Thanks very much, Yvonne, for joining us this afternoon. Now, if you're a fan of Tommy Tiernan, well, you could head over to the US, because he does have a gig starting there in the coming months. But Tommy Tiernan fans in the US have been warned that there's a no phones policy at his gigs there. Anyone who is caught checking their notifications will be escorted out of the venue. Fans will have to place their smartphone devices, including watches, into a sealed pouch that only opens in specified areas. The comedian previously used the technology at Vicar Street in Dublin and says it helped create a fantastic atmosphere. So, yeah, I think I'd be on for that, you know. Turn off your phone for a couple of hours. Like, how long would the gig be? Maybe two hours, three hours? Everyone, you know, everywhere you go now, me included, you see people and their head is always looking down in their phone, texting. And really, we don't really need to be doing that. So, I think it's a good idea. Now, just to let a few people know that there are leak detection works taking place tonight in Strafford, Salins, Clane and surrounding areas. Works are scheduled to take place from 11 p.m. until 4 a.m. tomorrow morning, so you should have your water back by tomorrow morning. Ishka Éireann does say that you should allow 2 to 3 hours for supply to fully return there. Now, coming up after the break, we will be speaking to a leading member of the Women's Ordination Worldwide Group. So I want to know, do you think that women should be ordained in the church? 0833 97 97 97. We'll talk after the break.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, the Women's Ordination Worldwide aims to challenge discrimination against women in the Catholic Church, which they call medieval misogyny, and whose mission is the ordination of women into the church. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Miriam Dignan. She's a leading member of Women's Ordination Worldwide. Good afternoon, Miriam.
Hi, Caoimhe.
Miriam, tell us about this group and, I suppose, your work.
Well, we're an organisation, an umbrella organisation, which basically represents all of the reform groups around the world whose mission includes the ordination of women to all ministries in the Catholic Church. And our main focus really is on campaigning and raising awareness. So we go to Rome all the time. We were just in the Vatican for the opening of the Synod of Bishops that just started there in October. And we organize colorful visual protests, basically to draw attention to the fact that there are all these men meeting inside the Vatican talking about the Catholic world and the Catholic parishes, and not a single woman is inside with the authority to have an equal say in how our church is run. And so our job really is to draw attention to it, not only the injustice of having banned women from the altar, you know, barely 1,000 years ago, and the lies that propagate that exclusion, being constantly told that women were never in authority, never presided at the altar, which isn't true, but also to draw attention to the injustices that the church propagates around the world because they refuse to acknowledge women as equals, and that's what the ban on priesthood is all about. It's not really a theology of priesthood. It is simply prejudice.
Okay,
that's our mission.
I think most people would probably assume, just like you've said there, you know, that women never had any authority in the church and they never had leading roles. Is that not true?
It's certainly not true, and
okay.
Even the Vatican itself acknowledges it. Well, the main reason that we're always told about, and probably all of your listeners would have heard this reason over and over again, is that Jesus only chose 12 male apostles, and therefore that model was of priesthood, and that was his intention going forward forevermore. And the fact is that wasn't true. There were women apostles as well as men apostles. It was just those first 12 men were chosen by Jesus to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. That was a specific cultural message at the time for his Jewish audience in that time and place. Further to those 12 men, we then had Mary Magdalene, who was known and recognized actually by the official church as the apostle to the apostles. We then have in the letter of St. Paul to the Romans, we have Junia named as an apostle among many other female apostles. You know, so it's based, that very basic theologically incorrect premise is it's a lie, and it's an intentional lie. And we can see from history, from the gospel, but also history in terms of artifacts of what women were doing at the most important altars in Christendom, that women were doing everything that men did, and that was as their equals and not their subordinates. They were presiding at the altar, they were running communities, they were recognized as leaders of the early Christian church, you know, to the point that the Roman culture of the time thought that Christians were completely crazy because they included women in their leadership structure, that they were co-leaders with their men. They were peers. And you know, as the Roman prejudice, that culture crept in and the Catholic Church became the official church of the Roman Empire, women had to be got rid of because their model was that women can't be seen as equal as men. They need to get home, stay home, and men are leaders. And then you have the medieval misogynists, you know, the medieval theologians who basically said women cannot be at the altar alongside men because they're inferior. You know, the main teaching of the main theologians, the Catholic Church, still references, like Tertullian, like Thomas Aquinas, they basically said women cannot hold authority. Their body is inferior. They are subordinate by their nature, and therefore they cannot hold the sacrament of holy orders. Very few of those medieval theologians that the church still quotes as being, you know, responsible for our teaching and our tradition mention Jesus, because the theology doesn't stand up to scrutiny, and the Anglican Church knows that, and that's why they had to ordain women. So the Catholic Church now relies on using phrases such as, well, we don't want women to become priests and become clericalized. Ministry is not what it's all about. We want women to be recognized as equals, but they don't have to become priests. But if priesthood is so irrelevant to the official Catholic Church, why are they still ordaining men? Why are they still crying out for vocations to ordain men into that sacrament if it's not important, if they're planning on phasing it out?
Okay.
The fact is, it's simply prejudice, and it needs to be called out, recognized, and challenged.
Okay. How are your views and I suppose the work that you're trying to do and where you're trying to get to, how is that viewed within the church at the moment, and how are you received? Like, I assume that you're a regular mass goer if you're, you know, trying to become a priest. Is that your ultimate goal, Miriam, to become a priest?
No, Quiver, actually, I don't have a vocation for priesthood
okay.
at all. I'm a campaigner, I'm an activist, I'm working with theologians and academics, but I don't have a vocation to priesthood. I know many, many wonderful women who do. But for me, it is a justice issue, and it is something that I feel very strongly about. But how we were received, you know, the synod that is taking place right now, they have had, the church has organized a lot of listening sessions all around the world. Some parishes participated, some didn't. But all of the documents that were submitted to the Vatican, the synod office, from all around the world, you know, not just Western democracies, but everywhere, called out the issue of women's ordination and the injustice. So ordinary parishioners, Catholic people, everywhere can see the injustice of all of these women who are essentially running their churches, preparing families for sacraments, but then they have to wait for a male ordained priest to come in and sort of put his hands, his holy ordained hands on the sacraments, and the woman is not allowed to finish basically the job that they started. And that injustice is so glaring for ordinary Catholics around the world that it's a big topic at the synod right now. And but, you know, the clerics at the very top of the hierarchy in the Catholic Church, a lot of them are very hardline, arch-conservative men who love being in an all-male clerical cast of priests and not having women as their peers and having to work with women. And they are determined to keep women excluded. But the vast majority of Catholics around the world are saying, you have to do something about this injustice. We can all see it in our churches, in our communities. And so it's a mixed reaction, really. We know that popular opinion is on our side. Everyone is so supportive of what we're doing and all of the events we had in Rome last week. But yet when we were protesting in Rome, the Vatican instructed the police to keep us 1 kilometer away. We had police cars blocking our path so that after we had finished our public demonstration and our witnesses, we were not allowed to even walk towards St. Peter's. We were told to take the back streets and go in the opposite direction. We had a police escort wherever we went. And so they don't want to see us. They want to keep us away. And that's still, you know, it's a small but very vocal and very powerful minority of those hard right-wing, basically, clerics who are desperately afraid of people understanding the true injustice and the scale of the dishonesty that is involved in telling people that women weren't and can't be priests.
Okay, so you're saying the institution itself, the Catholic Church, not very receptive to women being ordained, but that the wider public that and people who are Catholic want to see women priests?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Would you like to see women priests, and then, you know, after that, would you like to see priests be allowed to marry men or women?
Oh, God, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's another injustice. And you know, the two injustices, they all come from the same root, and that was kicking women out of the places where powerful men got to meet, you know, almost like a military caste of all-male privilege and separation. So the priests in the Catholic Church used to be married, and celibacy was imposed on the priesthood around the year 1130, and women were officially banned from the altar around the year 1150. It happened at the same time, and that was basically scrubbing women from any connection with the leadership of the church. They wanted to make sure that the priests had nothing to do with women and that women had nothing to do with the church. And so, of course, celibacy must be removed because it was imposed for absolutely wrong reasons, terrible theology, and basically just trying to create this all-male caste of military-style priesthood, which it never was supposed to be. So that has to go, and women's ordination has to be restored. So the two are very connected, and the two things are justice issues that must be fixed.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Miriam Dignan, leading member of the Women's Ordination Worldwide Group. Thank you very much, Miriam, for joining us. Now, many autistic people face serious barriers accessing healthcare, leaving them at risk of delayed diagnosis, untreated life-threatening illnesses, and potentially premature death, a new study reveals. I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Mary Doherty. She's a leading author of this new study. She's an anaesthetist in Navan Hospital. Good afternoon, Mary.
Hello, Caoimhe.
Mary, tell us about this new study.
Yeah, we published this study yesterday, and it looks at the barriers that autistic people face accessing healthcare, and how those barriers can link into really poor healthcare outcomes for autistic people. And we've known from previous studies that, and even work that we published last year, showed that up to 80% of autistic people have difficulty accessing a GP, for example, when they need to. And that's simple things like, you know, difficulty using the phone, for example, difficulty using public transport to access healthcare. the sensory environment in waiting rooms. So people have difficulty accessing healthcare. And then subsequently, once people do manage to access healthcare services, there's so many difficulties and challenges interacting with healthcare providers. And our study yesterday, it looks at the previous study was the statistics. This study looks at the human stories behind the statistics and how it all fits together to lead to really poor outcomes for autistic people.
Okay. Mary, this is something close to your heart because a decade ago you were actually diagnosed with autism.
Yeah, absolutely. My son was identified as autistic and I realised that, well, if he was autistic, I certainly was.
Okay.
So I went and had an assessment and got my own diagnosis and it has been absolutely life-changing.
When you know, does it make more sense? Like, are you able to navigate life better when you know, like, maybe certain issues or things that you once wondered about and now you can pinpoint, okay, well, that's that?
Oh, goodness, yeah. There's no comparison. Honestly, it was like getting a manual to my brain. It's so many things throughout my life that I really didn't understand why things were so much more difficult. It's just wonderful to understand how my brain works, to realise that I'm a perfectly good autistic person and not some sort of failed version of a non-autistic person.
Yeah.
That's been completely life-changing.
Mary, from the study, there was more than 1,200 autistic adults from the UK and Ireland and the United States. One of the person was found to be too anxious to see a doctor despite having had a heart attack, and another was unable to describe the symptoms leading to a large undiagnosed tumour. Just some of the things that can happen.
Yeah, some of the stories that we heard, some of the data was absolutely heartbreaking. That one in particular about somebody, you know, having had previous, you know, heart problems and just knowing that this was another heart attack and just not being able to, you know, face the anxiety of accessing healthcare. Really, really, really scary. As a doctor for myself, just reading these stories and knowing how medically serious these conditions really were, we had somebody who described feeling a breast lump and just not being able to access care, not being able to get to the GP. Other people who had delayed diagnosis, so a burst appendix and you know, life-threatening infection rather than seeing a doctor early and potentially getting treated early. It was really hard data to analyse.
So what is the solution then to this? Like, is it special doctors, like doctors that specialise in, you know, treating autistic people or, you know, that people can go to, you know, like a sensory okay, for, you know, places for them to be? What do we do?
I think we need training for all healthcare professionals across all fields, both medical and allied health professionals, because autism is everybody's business. I mean, it's much more common than people realise. So all doctors, all healthcare professionals are going to be treating autistic people. And while training is the greatest need, we have developed a solution that may potentially offer, one way of approaching this. And it's a framework that we published. We've included it in yesterday's paper, but we initially published it earlier this year. And it's a framework called Autistic Space. And it's not a separate space for autistic people. It's just a way of mentally thinking about autism. It's a framework that is accessible and easily memorable. Because commonly what we find is that our colleagues want to help, but autism can seem quite complex if you're not familiar with it. So people need a simple framework. And this framework, Autistic Space, really seems to meet that need. And what it stands for is sensory needs, predictability, acceptance, communication, and empathy.
Okay.
And then there's three further domains: physical space, processing space, and emotional space.
Do you think that there's more of an awareness around autism now, Mary? Are we getting a little bit better?
Oh, hugely. Oh, absolutely, for sure. And I think where a lot of that is coming from is autistic adults speaking out, because I think we are the first generation of autistic adults who were able to give voice to our own experiences. We remember what it was like to be, you know, autistic kids. We're found in all fields, right across all sort of, you know, employment sectors, and people are starting to speak out now. And the other thing that's happening is a lot of people are recognising themselves as autistic after their children are diagnosed, as I did, you know, and there's a growing awareness of this lost generation of autistic adults who are just not picked up in childhood. Awareness is most definitely increasing, but what we really need is understanding and acceptance.
Okay. Is there anything that the public can do to help people with autism in terms of getting healthcare and helping them, you know, maybe offering to drive them somewhere, going with them? Is there anything that would ease that burden?
I think what we really need to do is we need to challenge the stigma around autism and around being autistic and make it easier for autistic people to be openly autistic, because that's the way that awareness will really accelerate. And that benefits everybody, because it means that autistic people don't have to mask, which is trying to hide the fact that we're autistic, trying to hide our autistic traits. And that has really negative effects for mental health particularly.
Okay. Dr. Mary Doherty, founder of Autistic Doctors International, Associate Clinical Professor at the UCD School of Medicine and diagnosed with autism a decade ago. Thank you very much, Dr. Doherty, for joining us this afternoon.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hardy.
Now, despite significant advances in science and modern medicine, as well as growing scepticism towards traditional or alternative treatments, research shows that the Irish cures have not entirely lost their appeal. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Carol Barron. She's Associate Professor in the School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health at DCU. And Carol is going to talk to us about Irish folk remedies. Good afternoon, Dr. Barron.
Hi, Caoimhe. How are you?
Carol, I think everyone probably knows someone who's had thrush and gone to someone who's like never met their father or was born after their father. You know, you can get a cure for jaundice, ringworm then cured by the seventh son, all these different things that many people will be very, very familiar with.
It's very, very common in Irish history. We actually did a national collection back in 1937, 38, and we have a huge archive. One of the questions they asked, it was collected from primary school children, was about cures. So we actually have a record of the cures. It's probably the biggest folklore medical cures in Europe. So we have a large reservoir that we can look at what people used to believe and still see some remains of that today.
Okay. Are these pagan traditions or are they linked to Christianity and the Catholic Church?
Good question. There's a mix.
Okay.
There's a mix. Some of them are, you know, do a particular action and then make the sign of the cross or say three Hail Mary. So Irish people had no problem mixing modern medicine, religion and paganism in the cures. It was whatever works.
Okay, so it is a mix because, you do hear of people who, I know there is one man in Kildare, I can't think of his name, but he has the cure for thrush and he told me a story before that he was brought to Clongowes Wood in Kildare to see the Jesuit priests when he was born because, like that, his father had died before he was born and he had the cure for thrush. And he said he spent his childhood cycling around different parts of Kildare curing people. But obviously that was linked to the church, but others then maybe have no Christian significance at all. Is this cropping up in other parts of the world, like in Buddhism or in, you know, the Muslim faith?
Yes, there are beliefs about particular people under certain circumstances have curing abilities. Sometimes it's to do with your surname or where you come in a family, like seventh son or the posthumous child, or another Irish one would be two people who get married who have the same surname.
Mm.
Different religions and different cultures may ascribe slightly different priorities to who would have healing powers, but a lot of cultures would believe that certain individuals would have healing powers, yes.
Okay.
It's not unique to Ireland.
Okay. Tell us then about two people who get married who have the same surname. What kind of healing powers would they have?
They could heal a couple of conditions.
Right.
And a lot of them tended to be infection-based.
Okay.
And sometimes it was even, it would go as far as if your godmother. It wouldn't just be two names, but that would be a classic one, and that would be in every county in Ireland. There's cures there. And just going back to what you were saying about this gentleman going around the country curing everybody of thrush, there's lovely stories in the folklore collection, the Irish folklore collection, that one boy is telling us that he missed school. And, you know, the teacher was asking him, you know, why weren't you in school yesterday, Johnny? He said, I had to go 3 miles to cure so-and-so. You know, have to give them the shush. Now, that's the best dog ate my homework excuse ever.
I think I'd like that one. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Any other common ones that people might not know about, Carol?
I think if you look at what a lot of the cures were for in Ireland, things like dandelions were used a lot. We had an awful lot of cures for warts.
Okay.
We had a lot of cures for toothache, because if you think, well, this collection was back in the 1930s, and at the time, there was minimal dentists in Ireland at that time, so we've always had toothaches. You know, if you think of that Keith Duffy show recently, people used to pack tobacco into teeth, you know, as a packing agent if they had a sore tooth, or they would wash it out with salt and water, which would be more common still today. So we tended to have cures for what was ailing people at the time.
Okay. So maybe modern medicine has kind of, you know, come a long way and they're no longer needed. But still a lot of people, Carol, use these. And, you know, I've heard of people go to someone and they don't know what's wrong with them. You know, they have an ache, but they can't, you know, say where it is. They don't know where it's coming from. They go to a healer and the healer puts their hands over them and they say, yeah, you've got such and such a thing in your hip. And then that actually is what's wrong with them.
Yeah, I would put a word of caution in there, because sometimes, you know, there's belief and then there's medicine and where you're mixing the two.
Okay.
But I think if you go to any supermarket in Ireland or any chemist, how many herbal teas are there? You know, so we're still using a lot of these beliefs, but just in a different, more modern form.
Okay. In terms of then, like, Seventh Sons, is that still a very widely known and used tradition?
Yeah, Seventh Son, Posthumous Child, they would be very common. And sometimes it could be passed down. Maybe the mother was thought to have healing properties and she'd pass it on to her child. And it may be because of where the child's place in the family, or it may be that they just learned a lot about herbs through their parents, things like that.
Okay. A seventh son actually has to be seventh son and not seventh in the family, is it?
Seventh son.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I doubt there's many of those healers left around now.
No.
And that's the other thing, because they seem to be always very kind of, not far-fetched, but there's very few people now that have seven children, let alone seven sons. So then you would think that maybe that healing power might kind of die out as time goes on. Yeah.
Yeah, and with the posthumous child, you know, so because the mortality rate is much better now for adults. So those two you would think would waning, but they're still well known. They're still very well known throughout the country. And even things like, there's still strong belief in the power of something like holy wells.
Okay.
Throughout the country. And they would be associated, holy wells tend to be a bit of a cure-all. They can cure everything, but they are concentrated on some particular ailments like eye issues, so conjunctivitis, blindness, and anything like that. And some of the holy wells are called tubernosul, you know, the holy well, the eye well.
Okay, very interesting. And I know there's a few holy wells around Kildare. We could talk all day, Carol, but unfortunately I have to finish up. But thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Carol Byron, Associate Professor in the School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health at DCU, telling us there about Irish folk remedies. Thanks, Carol, for joining
us.
That's all I have time for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3.